Welcome to Beethoven Was a Rockstar. In this podcast, we are exploring the limits between music styles and why we created so many labels to define them. My name is Alexandra Riche. I'm the conductor of Night of the Proms and the music director of the Henderson Symphony Orchestra. I'll be interviewing iconic figures from both classical and pop music to find where the boundaries are and break through them. In this episode, we continue our conversation with Christopher Gibbs. We talked about the first rock stars, how the concerts were structured, the role of critics, and what was the social media at the time. So let's get started. How were the performances before the 20th century comparing to what we have now? When we start having all those rules, you know, you cannot clap, you cannot do this, how that started?
Yeah, now that's a great question. It opens up various things. So it's worth exploring. So let me see if I can keep them all going here. Some of it is the world that we think about in classical music now did not exist for Beethoven and Schubert in 1820 in Vienna. There was no Vienna Philharmonic. There was no permanent concert hall. Concerts were relatively rare events, in part because it was a quite repressive society and you needed to get permission from the police, from the authorities, to publish, to give public events, much more things that we would associate with Stalinist Soviet Union and what Shostakovich went through in the 20th century. Concerts were very different from what would happen by the end of the century. They were sort of circus events. They were a mixture of so many different things. We really think now the most cliche program would be an overture by Rossini, a concerto by Tchaikovsky, and a symphony by Beethoven. Mm-hmm. Mix a, you know, an Italian, a Russian, and a German. Leon Bostein would say it gives you indigestion. You wouldn't eat a meal like this. Yeah. It's all mixed up.
Yeah, it's funny because I often also relate those types of concerts of programs with meals too, like the first course, the second course.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and then the dessert.
Yeah, and an encore. So the more standard concert, well, there weren't so many of them. They tended to be benefits either for charities or that Beethoven would give himself, that he would hire the orchestra. The orchestras were connected to the theaters. And so at certain times, like during Lent and Advent, their operas wouldn't be presented. So the theaters themselves were free and the orchestras were free. So you could rent the theater, the opera house, to give your concert and you could have use of the orchestra. This is what Beethoven did around the premiere of the Fifth Symphony, for example, in December in Advent. So these concerts were very long. They mixed together lots of different things. Begin with an overture, and then somebody would sing an aria, and then a pianist would improvise, and then there would be one movement of a concerto, and then there would be a chorus. It's truly a mixed media thing. Symphonies might be distributed over the course of the program. You heard the first movement, then you would have the aria, then an improvisation, then the second movement. So you didn't even hear the symphony all at once, or maybe you didn't hear all the movements of the symphony. It wasn't only that people were told, don't clap in between things. You absolutely clapped after a movement because that gave the indication of whether the movement should be repeated or not, which often happened. We have Mozart letters, like he's in Paris and he says, my new Paris symphony, you know, did great. They loved it. I had to do the second movement three times because they wouldn't, the audience wouldn't let it go on. Then he says, like, and they loved the opening of it. Well, how do we know they love the opening of it? Because they clap during the music. It's like, you know, sometimes happens in ballet now or something, of the audience showing this spontaneous reaction. So it was, in other words, not like being in church, which is what happened over the course of the 19th century, of the sacralization of orchestral music and of so-called classical music. And so this whole thing is just so different of the mixture of pieces and genres and of people interrupting and of it taking a very long time, being terribly under rehearsed. I mean, these orchestras were not astounding groups and there weren't star conductors. And there was usually just one rehearsal on the day of the concert. And people fantasize, oh, how wonderful it would be to hear, have heard the premiere. I don't think so. I think we would view that this is like the worst middle school orchestra, you know, trying to get through these pieces. Medieval dentistry or something. It's just, it probably was absolutely horrible. We know that one of, well, Beethoven's longest concert in December 1808 had the premiere of the Fifth Symphony. World premiere of the Sixth Symphony, world premiere of the Fourth Piano Concerto, other pieces, choral pieces, and ended with his so-called choral fantasy for piano, orchestra, and chorus, in which reviews said it broke down. It, you know, it had to be restarted because the players and Beethoven got lost. So over the course of the 19th century, we begin to get to what now is pretty much remained for over 150 years. So the snapshot of Beethoven's world again would be most of the music being performed were by living composers, maybe 80% living people and 20% the dead Mozart or Handel or Haydn, performed by professional but not the greatest orchestras in alternative spaces, in under-rehearsed performances on sort of potpourri circus concerts. That really, one of my favorites is a concert in 1806 that was the premiere of the Beethoven Violin Concerto. And it was given by the soloist that was his benefit concert, Franz Clement, a violinist. And one of the things on the concert was Clement will play a sonata that he had written on the violin for one string upside down, truly like a circus act. Look at what I can do. I'm playing a piece of music on just one of the strings of the violin and I'm holding the instrument upside down. So that world changes over the course of the 19th century to more by the 1880s and 90s, what we think of. The Vienna Philharmonic exists, the Musikverein, where we see the annual New Year's Day concert from Vienna that's very popular, right? This beautiful hall has been built. The concerts now, 80% of the music is by dead composers and 20% is by living composers. There are great star conductors that are, you know, focused on really bringing together great performances by a great orchestra of this great music that's taking place now in this sort of temple of music, this very beautiful structure where people come dressed up and remain silent and much more of a worshipful, that's why sacralizing this. It becomes much more like church and a museum and much more sort of fussy and elitist and so forth. A lot of the bad associations with classical music happen in this process of making it seem detached from entertainment and from a more relaxed type of atmosphere. That's actually much truer to what would have been at the beginning of the century.
When was the rock star figure, like when that concept started?
Well, it's interesting. We call them rock stars, sort of projecting back that, you know, if it was Elvis or whoever the rock star is, that was our frame of reference, you know. But so you call somebody 200 or 300 years ago that they were the rock star of their time. And maybe it should be the other way around. We should say that Elvis was the Farinelli or the Caruso or whatever, because sort of the same mechanisms, logic, structures, and so forth are quite familiar going back centuries. I would say the first of these performing superstars were probably singers, not instrumentalists, and rather specifically the so-called castratos of primarily the 17th and 18th century. These were figures that fit in with many of our visions of what we associate with a rock star. They were fabulously well paid. They were broadly, you know, admired and lionized and had groupies. There were souvenirs and a publicity machine around them and so forth. So we're talking in this instance about primarily the Baroque era and into, but including Mozart's world, really ends in the beginning of the 19th century. And I don't want to get too graphic about what's going on here, but these were singers that had been brilliantly trained boy sopranos and are castrated before puberty, and they retain their great musicianship, their ability to do all these marvelous things, but they begin to develop the sort of physiognomy of a man and the chest power and lung power and so forth, but retain a very high voice. So they're sopranos, although actually sort of more tenor to soprano. Great range, great power of voice. It's supernatural. For the most part, we can only read about it and know what Handel and Mozart and others' relationships were with these famous figures. The so-called last castrato was connected with the Sistine Chapel, so with the church, in the early 20th century. And there are recordings that give you a little bit of an idea, except the recording sound is so bad, and this wasn't a great star. But you can get a little bit of an idea that it's an uncanny, strange, supernatural type of sound. And so these figures, as I say, were just, you know, enormously popular. They would tour around. So let's say they would be in Naples performing an opera there. You know, an opera has a story, a plot line to it, and so forth. But the rock star castrato would oftentimes insert their most popular aria. They were sometimes called suitcase arias because it was just expected at some point, the hell with the plot, that they would just insert their most famous piece so that everybody could hear, you know, their great tune.
So it's like someone performing a Verdi opera and then out of the blue start singing a Donizetti in the middle?
Yeah. In the opera world, you've probably seen this in lots of times on New Year's Eve performances, they perform the wonderful sort of popular, you could say, operetta by Johann Strauss Jr., Die Fledermaus, the bat. And there's a party in the opera. And so it's a wonderful excuse to just have guests sing. So in walks, you know, this superstar singer and maybe a pianist, and sort of, so for 25 minutes, an hour, the sort of opera plot stops and they just have this party with all these inserted musical stars and hit tunes and so forth. It sort of shows that the castrati were these fantastically popular figures that would tour around, as I said, were very rich, had souvenirs, and people wanted to collect things related to them, their portraits and so forth and so on.
And they were the first artists to start touring?
Well, no, you could even go back to the Middle Ages with, you know, the jugglers and the wandering minstrels and so forth, you know, the traveling musician that were performing more popular music. And they, the whole idea is that they're sort of touring people that are entertaining from town to town. But I think what we would associate more with a real personality were these singers, going back even further, but particularly the castratos. It's funny that it continues to a certain extent of the higher voice, you know, in the opera world today. It's more the three tenors, right? That were that was in the 1990s, but that was, you know, the hit thing to have Pavarotti, Domingo, and Carraras sing together. And the soprano, the Anna Netrebko's and Renee Fleming's, rather than the superstar being a bass or being a contralto or something like that. There's this attraction to the higher end of the voice.
Yeah, to the limits. Yeah, exactly.
To the limits. And, you know, Caruso, Enrico Caruso, the great Italian tenor, the beginning of the 20th century, the fees that he commanded and his popularity. He was the first person, he made his first recordings in 1902. He was the first star of the phonograph, of the new technology, of people being able to buy recordings by Enrico Caruso. And these were sort of more pop things. He would be sometimes singing popular arias, La Donna Mobile of Verdi and so forth, but also Neapolitan songs and and literally sort of more popular music. And I'm a record collector, so I have some of the original 78s, and sometimes the price is on it. We're talking 3 minutes of music in, you know, 1908 that cost $7. I mean, that's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars for a 3 minute disc on one side of Enrico Caruso singing a Verdi aria.
Coming back to the castratis, were they freelancers? Were they sponsored? What made them have the careers that they had?
I think for the most part, they were freelancers that sometimes would be associated, become more connected with, you know, an opera house. And I'll mention one because there's a fantastic movie called Farinelli. Mm-hmm. And his real name was Carlo Broschi, was really a star in the 1720s. And he was based in London for a while, where Handel was, and Handel was writing his operas for London at the time. But this guy traveled all over the place, and he had his suitcase arias. Most popular one was written by his brother, Riccardo Broschi. And as I say, it's maybe 20 years ago, but there was a movie called Farinelli that gives you a little bit of a taste of this.
Yes, I remember this movie. And something that I completely forgot is that his name was not Farinelli. So that fashion of changing your name to become more famous, it started there too.
Yes, and a lot of them just had the one name, Prince Beyonce, right? There are a lot of sort of parallels. And then I think what happened is this moves more into the instrumental realm. You know, Mozart and Beethoven were great virtuoso pianists, but in part the instrument hadn't developed to the point that you could dazzle in the way that we now think of pianists just playing so fast, so loud, with such a broad range. We think of 88 keys on a modern piano. There were many fewer keys, they were smaller, and the technology just hadn't developed really until later into the 19th century. So the first real superstar in the rock star of instrumental world probably was Paganini, the violinist, Niccolo Paganini. And he as well has some of this things that we would associate with the rock world, not just the souvenirs, the touring, very high ticket prices. He charged double of what was expected at the time, but he dressed like all in black. You know, he had an attitude, right? He dressed sort of like, you know, a downtown New Yorker now. And his appearance was strange. He was very tall, very thin. And there's long been an association of the instrument of the violin with the devil. This goes back to the Middle Ages, and there's a famous piece by Tartini, The Devil's Trill, and the idea that the devil or a skeleton plays the violin. So with Paganini, you know, the critics and the audiences were making these associations that this was a demonic force and that it was superhuman. So he sort of sets a model. I think he was born in 1782. And around 1830, I guess he would have been 19-year-old Franz Liszt heard him play in Paris and said, I want to become I want to become the Paganini of the piano. And within a few years, that's what the critics were calling Franz Liszt. And he, I would say, is really, I know the title of the series is Beethoven as rock star, but really the closest you get is Franz Liszt, who, for one thing, had a very long life. He was born in 1811 and he died in 1886. So as a child, he met Beethoven. By the end of his life, he met Debussy, and he knew everybody in between. Again, we don't have recordings, but the accounts of what his playing was like, and then the music that he wrote for the piano, is just of superhuman difficulty and virtuosity and just simply extraordinary. And he did a tour for 10 years, beginning at the age of 27 to 37. He was in Russia and St. Petersburg. He was in Dublin. He was in southern Spain. And he just sort of looped around again and again. This is for the most part before railroads. He's really traveling by coach, by mail coach. It is not fancy circumstances and accommodations and so forth. He'd arrive and the piano would be terrible. The instrument was terrible and so forth. I've done a fair amount of research of this, in part because in this decade of touring, one of the things that he played most often were his own transcriptions or arrangements of Schubert songs. And Schubert is the principal composer I study. How did Schubert become famous? Well, it was the rock star playing his music in St. Petersburg. That is probably the first time anybody in Russia encountered the name of Schubert, and Schubert had been dead over 10 years. So it's very important for the spread of somebody like Schubert's fame. And Liszt was, as a younger man at this time, he was gorgeous. Just, you know, rock star, well, handsome rock star, because he actually becomes terribly decrepit, and the old Liszt is not very attractive to look at. But if you look at this gorgeous young man and an appeal to women that and the groupies and so forth, that's quite well documented. He had long-term affairs, but and usually with married women, and but the most important was with Countess Marie Dagou, with whom he had three children. One of them, Cosima, went on to marry Richard Wagner. So Liszt became the father-in-law,
of
one of the most important composers in the second half of the century. So, I mean, literally, the sort of sex, drugs, and rock and roll component is part of Liszt's world. He drank way too much, and the women were just constantly around him. The souvenirs, the wanting to get his gloves. It's sort of like Michael Jackson, right?
Yeah.
There's a, it, now, I don't think this is a very good movie, but there's a movie called Listomania, which was a term at the time coined by the poet Heinrich Heine. So Beatlemania, this had its 19th century version. And in this movie, the role of Liszt is played by Roger Daltrey of The Who. So a rock star playing a rock star.
I'm curious about certain things that you mentioned. One is Liszt made Schubert famous by playing during his tour. And what made then like certain composers to survive to the times? And what was the media of that? Because we know nowadays, like social media and managers and, you know, like this basically molds what we hear. So what was the similar force at the time?
I think in large part, it's other musicians, and which means both composers revering earlier composers. Who's your hero and your model as you're writing your student compositions, your early mature compositions? you know, which composers do you revere the most? And then for performers, who do you want to play and what pieces do you want to play? And Beethoven was, for much of his career, considered a very challenging composer, that his music was literally longer, more difficult to play. And by the end, he was viewed that he was deaf and he was a great genius, but it's very sad. He is too eccentric, too weird, incomprehensible, and crazy, as some people would say. And yet, if you read reviews of like his third symphony, the Eroica Symphony, which you could say is the symphony that changes the history of the symphony. The fifth symphony is now more famous, but the third, which he had written a few years before, just like, you know, Haydn had written, his own teacher, Haydn, had written over 100 symphonies. Mozart wrote about 50 symphonies. And here with Beethoven, with his third symphony, it's like everything before it is just sort of blown up. It's twice as long. It's got more instruments. It's just terrifically complex. And I'm always fascinated with reviews and the reception and what was said. And you read the very first reviews and people are baffled by it is so long. It's not beautiful. Whoa. It's sublime. It's terrifying. It's so difficult. And then it doesn't take so many years. We're talking 5 to 10 years that you read in reviews saying, now that we've heard this many times, now that it's published and we can study it, it's not to be entertained, but there are things more profound than being entertained. The musicians, without being paid, wanted extra rehearsals because they love the music so much. So, you know, I mean, that happens relatively quickly because, I mean, it is just an astonishing accomplishment of a symphony and more satisfying to be playing than most of what's around. So I would say for the most part, you know, this works pretty well at a certain time of musicians understanding, promoting, and so forth. The case of Schubert, which, as I say, you know, is close to my heart because of my working so much on his career, is he has the dubious distinction of dying the youngest of any of the great composers at the age of 31. And he didn't travel and he didn't tour and he wasn't a virtuoso performer himself promoting his music as Mozart could do for himself, Beethoven for himself, Liszt for himself. And so there are various things that make his career very strange and unusual. And it therefore required, again, musicians to just say, but this is Beethoven's successor. This is the greatest next composer. And that was Liszt and Felix Mendelssohn and Robert Schumann. So, you know, the great next generation just after Schubert are all just Schubert fanatics. And Schumann goes to Vienna to visit Schubert's older brother and says, is there unpublished music by his brother, by Franz? And all this music comes out, including Schubert's magnificent last great C major symphony. And Schumann can't believe this. He takes it back to Leipzig, gives it to Mendelssohn, and the piece is premiered 10 years after Schubert's death. So all these things keep on happening of more and more and more Schubert music that people didn't know about. And at the same time, Liszt is traveling all over the continent, promoting his name and so forth. So it's Schubert's, I would say, a rather unusual instance.
So in this case, we'll be more like composers reverencing another composer. So do you think that a critic at that time could have killed careers?
There are some very interesting cases because I would say there was a musical politics of the 19th century that maybe on the heels of the American election gets something that we can relate to of, you know, red and blue states and so forth. Well, there really were like, this is the type of music that should be written. And no, this is the type of music that should be written. So there are critics that are very powerful that have very strong views, and they're supporting their team, and then other critics supporting the other. So I don't think it's quite like they can kill off the other thing of like the bad New York Times review of a musical opening on Broadway. And if the reviews are terrible, that maybe it's killed. Although that's changed completely, you know, the social media mm-hmm. and the democratization of taste and so forth. But 20 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, it was still possible for two or three critics in New York to kill a Broadway show. And the 19th century version of that is a critic like Edward Hanslick, one of the most famous critics, supporting Brahms as that this is the true path of music, and that Wagner is the false path and don't get near Wagner and so forth. But he wasn't able to kill Wagner's mm-hmm. oh, career. Yeah. Wagner just gets angry and makes a parody of him in his opera Die Meistersinger and makes fun of critics and so forth. So the so-called war of the romantics is an interesting type of thing, because from our point of view now, they're only talking about all this high classical music. But some people are saying, you know, music needs to be connected to stories and to history and have so-called program. So you should write Romeo and Juliet, like Tchaikovsky, or the Symphonie Fantastique of Berlioz that tells a story. And then others say, no, it should be absolute. No, music is about music. And Brahms writes Symphony Number 1 in C minor, Symphony Number 2 in D major. They're all four movements and no stories and, you know, extra musical things. So that was the big debate. Should you be writing program music or absolute music? And now it's all sort of equalized. Well, yeah. They all just write this wonderful orchestral, you know, symphonies. Well, yes, but at the time it would have been viewed as some are writing from this aesthetic, philosophical perspective, and some are writing from a completely different one.
Thank you for listening. Next episode, we will talk to the first woman to be appointed music director of a major American orchestra, the first woman to conduct the last night of the proms, and so much more. I'm talking about the trailblazer, the one and only Mary Nosop. Don't forget to subscribe to Beethoven Was a Rockstar, and for more information, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube channel. See you next time.